Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We are a lay-led congregation. We welcome individuals with a variety of backgrounds, beliefs, and races, and are a welcoming congregation to people of all sexual orientations. I'm Nancy Schroff, and I will be the president. Any visitors or guests will have opportunities later in the service for introductions. Now, I just would like to bring to your attention something that we had years ago. It's called the announcement box. And because announcements have been going quite long lately, I'm going to pass this around today. And if you have an announcement, write down three W's, what, when, and where. And give them to me, and I will make those announcements.
Do you have one? I don't think so.
Okay, we'll start with our chalice lighting, followed by a few moments of contemplation.
Like the chalice for the electrons, where would we be without electrons? And good to understand is very important thing.
As soon as Warren mentioned electrons, I immediately had a picture in my mind of a small letter E and a negative sign next to it. Our first hymn is number one in the Prairie Songbook, Morning Has Broken. Service where we can share the joys and sorrows in our lives. Phoenix.
Under our counter crown, the first day of spring.
Well, sure looks like it, doesn't it? Other joys or sorrows? Orange.
I have a joy that turning to gorgeous as newly as I am. I had this idea that it would be really fun to do a Danny Boy marathon, playing Danny Boy all Danny Boy, at Kentop's grocery store, in part because I thought it would drive my staff crazy. Ken, I said, Ken, aren't you afraid of driving your staff crazy? And he said, I thought of that, but tell the truth, they're halfway there already. Katrina and I played on the flute and harp. We played 15 times on the keyboard. Oh, yeah. And to raise money for an Irish charity that brings Protestant and Catholic kids over, and they become friends, hopefully. And it was just such a goofy thing, and it was so much fun. And Ken Cochran was giving out corned beef sandwiches. They gave out 1,100 sandwiches.
Oh, wow. Looking well too.
Oh, thank you.
Other joys, Kathy, Sarah.
I want to say that we got to go to a live Market Land performance.
Ooh, wow.
Really exciting. And afterwards there was a private reception, so I got to join Tara as a tag along with dancer. We got to meet all the dancers. Wow. And we initiated the brand new Kennedy Dance Space. It's where it was called Camille's and Clothing Store used to be, but in the corner of State Street. So they finally have a home.
Great. Other joys, sorrows, Mary?
Well, I spent last Sunday with my parents, and one of the things we did is, their 94-year-old friend, minister friend, had died, and we were going to go, or my mother and I were going to go to Westfield to the memorial service, but they wanted to do something to honor him, so I had brought my guitar and harmonica, which they love, and it's nice to be loved. They sang together, and I played the guitar and harmonica, and we had a really good time.
That's you?
Norman Rockwell was wonderful. I've always liked him for the spirit and the symbolism in his paintings, but I also was just amazed and struck by how his command of light and texture, just wonderful. He's an excellent painter, as well as commercial painter and another fine arts man.
Paula?
I spent a week with my mother and my sister, and we had a wonderful time spending time together, getting to know each other, being busy, and being relaxed together. And it just happened to be in the Eastern Caribbean on a cruise ship. And my sorrow is that I'm concerned about my throat. I had a sore throat, and I'm to rest my voice until I see the specialist.
Oh, that's a sorrow for us too. Okay, Nikki?
It's my joy that finally after a week I finished putting up an exhibit that I initiated and put together with Meet the Photographers and doing. It's in the lobby of the Historical Society. It's called Picturing the South Side Community Portrait. And the really wonderful part about it is it's to show a different image of the South Side other than the negative one that comes in the media. But what's really fun is that we have two cases of the sixth grade class from James Wright School doing their own photographs and their own captions and their own comments. So go over to the lobby of the Historical Society. You'll be up to
the museum.
The Society, not the museum. Right across from the street.
Library Mall.
Library.
Judy.
I'd like to honor Ken Mack, who died this week. He was the owner of Mounds Pet Food Store. Anybody who has probably shopped there. Just all the wonderful work that he's done supporting the Humane Society and allowing us to bring our pets into the store.
Other joys or sorrows? Yes, Brandon.
I'll make sure for just want to say that Al had second overnight. Long ongoing saga learning more about sexuality. And
what's Al mean?
Oh, thanks. Al means our whole lives. It's a very integrated curriculum that UUA has put together over the years. And they have curriculums for K1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, and high school and adult. And the RE Committee of Prairie is trying to find how to integrate all this fine work together. And this year, Kings Cog and I joined James Reeve and their folks to do Al the 7th and 9th grade, and we're having a great time.
Other joys or sorrows? one sorrow. Pat Watkins last week apparently fractured a bone in her knee, and she has bone fragments swimming around, and she's been in incredible pain since about last Tuesday. She's going in tomorrow morning for an MRI at 6:30 a.m. Her doctor's concerned about some soft tissue damage, so we don't know how it fractured, but she's moving around with a walker, so she at least can be more mobile, but she can't stand for long, and she was very great disappointment, was unable to make the trip down to Chicago to the Norman Rockwell exhibit and the other things down there, and she had put so much time and work into that, and she was almost going to drive there to apologize, and I said, Pat. But anyway, so give her your good wishes.
And if you call, give her time to get to the phone.
Right. Right, yeah.
So she might even get the answering machine to stay on for a while.
Does she need a right to not be alive?
She can do it. She's there, so I'd like to
call. Anyone else? Okay. Well, Bob Lawrence looks like he's on next. Richard Feynman for children.
Yes, let me introduce Bob.
Oh, thank you.
Richard Feynman, where's the children? Yeah, you should come up. Richard Feynman was a very famous physicist. Physicists study things like electricity and light and sound and things like that. Feynman, however, was a very curious character. He was curious about everything in nature. And Bob will give you a couple of Feynman stories.
Okay, so Feynman was a scientist, and scientists are very, very serious. And he was also kind of a cut-up, you might say. He was kind of a folksy sort of ordinary person. I think these stories sort of tell that. So there are pictures, but they have to be in your imagination, okay? There are no pictures on the text. You just simply have to imagine. When I was at Los Alamos and would get a little time off, I would often go visit my wife, who was in a hospital in Albuquerque, a few hours away. One time I went to visit her and couldn't go in right away, so I went to the hospital library to read. I read an article in Science about bloodhounds. Dogs that are really good smell. And how they could smell so very well. The authors described the various experiments that they did. The bloodhounds could identify which items had been touched by people and so on. And I began to think, it is very remarkable how good bloodhounds are at smelling, being able to follow trails of people and so forth, but how good are we, actually? When the time came that I could visit my wife, I went to see her and I said, we're going to do an experiment. Those Coke bottles over there, she had a six-pack of empty Coke bottles that she was saving to send out. See, in those days, you saved your Coke bottles, and you could send them back to the store and get money for them because you had to pay a deposit on them, okay? Now, you haven't touched them in a couple of days, right? That's right. I took the six-pack over to her without touching the bottles and said, okay, now, I'll go out, and you take out one of the bottles. Handle it for about 2 minutes, and then put it back. Then I'll come in and try to tell which bottle it was. So I went out, and she took out one of the bottles and handled it for quite a while, lots of time, because I'm no bloodhound. According to the article, they could tell if you just touched it. Then I came back, and it was absolutely obvious. I didn't even have to smell the damn thing, because of course the temperature was different. And it was also obvious from the smell. As soon as you put it up near your face, you could smell it. It was dampish and warmer. So that experiment didn't work because it was too obvious. Then I looked at the bookshelf and said, those books you haven't looked at for a while, right? This time when I go out, take one off the shelf and just open it, that's all, and close it again, then put it back. So I went out again, she took a book, opened it, and closed it, and put it back. I came in, and nothing to it, it was easy. You just smell the books. It's hard to explain because we're not used to saying things about it. So put each book up to your nose and sniff a few times and you can tell. It's very different. A book that's been standing there a while has a dry, uninteresting kind of smell. But when a hand has touched it, there's a dampness and a smell that's very distinct. We did a few more experiments and I discovered that while bloodhounds are indeed quite capable, humans are not as incapable as they think they are. It's just that they carry their noses so high off the ground. I've noticed that my dog can correctly tell which way I've gone in the house, especially if I'm barefoot, by smelling my footprints. So I tried to do that. I crawled around the rug on my hands and knees, sniffing to see if I could tell the difference between where I walked and where I didn't. And I found it impossible. So the dog is much better than I am. Many years later, when I was first at Caltech, that's a university out in California, there was a party at Professor Backer's house. And there were a lot of people from Caltech. I didn't know how it came up, but I was telling them the story about smelling the bottles and the books. They didn't believe a word, naturally, because they always thought I was a faker. I had to demonstrate it. We carefully took 8 or 9 books off the shelf without touching them directly with our hands, and then I went out. 3 different people touched 3 different books. They picked one up, opened it, closed it, and put it back. Then I came back and smelled everybody's hands and smelled all the books. I don't remember which I did first, and found all 3 books correctly. I got 1 person wrong. They still didn't believe me. They thought it was some sort of a magic trick. Okay, so he was doing real science. He found out people really can smell a whole lot better than we think we can. Okay, there's another real short story here. This is by his sister, Joan Feynman. I was Richard Feynman's first student, and he was my first teacher. We were brother and sister, the only children in our family. When I was a baby, Richard would bundle me into my carriage and take me over to his friend Bernie's house. There he would prop me up so I could watch the 2 boys work with the batteries, wires, rheostats, switches, and radio tubes they had collected for their laboratory. He was 9. I soon graduated to larger tests. We had a dog, a fox terrier more or less, the kind you could see in circuses back then. The family taught him tricks, like sitting and begging, by patiently getting him to understand what was expected and then giving him a treat when he was successful. The dog worked hard for the dog biscuits and amazed the neighborhood children. Observing this, Richard decided that I was probably trainable too. And the most amazing trick he could think of to teach me was to do arithmetic. The problem was what to give me for a treat. Our mother was very careful with our diet, and I certainly couldn't have candy between meals. But he was very resourceful. When I got a problem correct, I was allowed to pull his hair until it hurt. or to be more exact, until he grimaced as if in great pain. I remember standing in my crib, maybe 3 years old, yanking on his hair with great delight while he excitedly planned to surprise Bernie with my new trick. I had just learned to add 2 and 3. I have always believed that the reason Richard had a full head of hair all his life was because I had done such a good job of strengthening the roots.
Children can go downstairs now for more RE. Let me just give you a little background. Richard Feynman was born in New York City in 1918 on Long Island. His father was in business, not all that successful. And his father thought his son should be a scientist, however. His mother, at least There's one story about this. His mother thought that the highest vocation was that of a comedian. She might have been joking. You know. Richard grew up, as the story indicated, doing lots of experiments around the house. Back there in the 1920s, he was good at playing with radios. Got any stories about that, Al?
Well, I just guess that the major thing to talk about is the fact that he was a 12-year-old who was actually called on by neighbors to fix radios. And he got a reputation. He was called the boy who fixes radios, I think. Because he figured out at 12 the logic of radio circuits and would logically figure out which parts were needing to be replaced. Now, one of the problems, of course, we have today is you can't tell which parts need to be replaced.
When he graduated from high school, he went to MIT. And then he got his PhD from, went to Princeton as a graduate student in 1938 or 1939. The Ivy League schools at that time were quite anti-Semitic, and it wasn't all that easy for him to get into to Princeton. And if you read the correspondence of the professors making recommendations or making decisions at Princeton, it's rather embarrassing. You know, he got into Princeton despite being a Jew. I mean, he had a very good record as an undergraduate. Got his PhD in 1942, and there was a war going on, and he was recruited for the atomic bomb project at Los Alamos. He was in love with a beautiful high school classmate, Arlene Greenbaum. However, they discovered she had tuberculosis and got married despite this, and she accompanied him out to New Mexico. It's sort of a nice tragic love story. They would worry about whether he should kiss her or not, because TB, after all, is highly contagious. Arlene had the rare ability to embarrass Richard. She sent him a box of pencils emblazoned, "Richard, darling, I love you, Pootsie." And then she caught him slicing off the incriminating legend because he was afraid he'd leave it on a professor's desk. And she chided him, saying, "What do you care what other people think?" And he evidently got the point. Arlene died in Albuquerque not long before the end of the war. Feynman made important contributions to the bomb. He was there at the first test at Alamogordo. And just before it went off, everybody was wearing big heavy sunglasses, everybody else, but he did some lightning calculations and concluded that the glass in the car where he was sitting would filter out the dangerous rays. So he might have been the only one who saw the first bomb without sunglasses. After the war, he went off to Cornell and continued doing the work in theoretical physics for which he got the Nobel Prize eventually. The theories of relativity and quantum mechanics had revolutionized physics in the 20s and early 30s. And then physicists encountered all sorts of problems with the theories. There were internal inconsistencies in the theories, so that if you did the logic, you'd conclude that the mass of the electron should be infinite, which obviously it isn't. Anyway, Feynman and a few others solved these problems and developed this theory of quantum electrodynamics, which is one of the most successful theories in all of science. They can make predictions about electrons that are worn out to about 20 decimal places, things like that. When I was an undergraduate, I thought I had a little grasp of modern physics, but that was a long time ago, and physics has changed, and I don't understand it now. I don't like it as much now. I know Feynman's kind of physics that is, you know, it's good. and who am I to judge a physicist about saying? Anyway, so I'm not going to explain the physics for you, but maybe Al can say something about it.
Well, I want to point out the pictures that we have over here. Caltech has a very large photo archive on the internet, and it turns out that they have several hundred photographs of Feynman available. And so we printed out a few of them. And I want to go down around the rotation. Feynman, as far as I'm concerned, falls in this category in the middle. This incredible, and come up and look at this picture, this incredible curiosity and impishness in relation to science. And he describes some of his boredom with science. And what broke it for him is he was sitting and watching some performers one day rotating these plates on the top of sticks. And so he's sitting in the audience figuring out why it is that the logo shows up at a certain frequency and cycle and doing the math of it, and realizes that you can have fun with this incredible curiosity about what the world is all about.
Turns out that electrons also spin.
Yeah, it's... All right, here he is getting a Nobel Prize. I'm going to come back to that one a little bit. But Feynman was an artist, studied printmaking, and sold drawings and paintings, and we may have some stories about those a little bit later. He was a juggler, and he loved the physics of juggling, of course. He was a bongo player, and here's a photograph of him with bongos to come and look at. And here's a picture of him at Carnival at Rio de Janeiro. And Warren, I'm wondering if you have any response to this. You talked about this guy being a physicist, but he says, "It is odd, on the infrequent occasions that I have been called upon in a formal place to play the bongo drum, the introducer never seems to find it necessary to mention that I do theoretical physics."
Wait a minute, I thought it was the other way around. Yeah. Feynman was interested in rhythm, so he would always be drumming along while thinking. When the first punched card machines arrived at Los Alamos, he set them up following the wiring diagrams and quickly discovered that he could wire them to produce the rhythms of popular songs. In 1950, he went to Rio de Janeiro to teach Brazilians some physics, but partly to learn how to play the samba, and that's why we started the program with the samba. After Brazil, he went to Caltech, where he taught for the rest of his career. He was a super teacher of undergraduates, perhaps the best we've had. When I was doing research for my doctoral dissertation, I interviewed him. Friends I knew in the physical sciences said, I really have to interview him. He was already famous for his style and his opinions. So I interviewed him for an hour or so back there in 1961. I still remember him as an extraordinary character. Can we hear him?
Sure. 1961 was when I was a freshman in college, and somehow the science teachers in my high school didn't do a very good job, because when I was in junior high, I actually received the first prize in the state science fair, and my prize for that year was the alumni magazine of Caltech. And when I was a freshman in high school, I was bound and determined I was going to go to Caltech. And somehow, if that hadn't stuck, I would have had the honor, perhaps, of having been in on Feynman teaching undergraduate physics in 1961. Mm-hmm. And then those same freshmen as sophomores the next year. And after that, he never did teach undergraduates again. A number of his lectures, he rarely wrote books, only articles. And most of the books that have Feynman's name on them, if you look carefully, are co-authored by someone else. In fact, authored by someone else. And in most instances, taking his stories or his lectures and publishing those. Recently, a CD has been issued with one of his lectures. It was not originally included in the physics lectures that have been published. This particular one wasn't published in the original series because somehow they lost the photographs of the blackboard. And those were very important. And I've asked Warren to do a little research at the university. We have a photograph in one of the books, and we'll try and find it, showing him lecturing on these big pull-down blackboards and others. And the question for Warren and his research is this technology gone from the university? Is it all from computer screens these days? But here's a bit of Feynman. I'm going to the part where he's answering questions after the lecture. He has just lectured to the freshmen on the planetary movements, figuring that Newton's use, his proofs were a little too incomprehensible, so he says he cooked up his own, but these proofs were all using plane geometry. So if you were to, any of you with knowledge of geometry, go back and listen to this lecture, you should be able to understand it.
Now there's a picture of him at the blackboards, many blackboards. You have to go to the classroom ahead of time to get your notebook.
See, if a line can lie inside the curve, it's not tangent, right? If it never goes inside the curve and does touch the curve, then it must be tangent. Well, I proved that if the line made equal angle, I went backwards. Instead of saying given the tangent, I said if a line makes equal angle, I prove it's tangent. And I suppose it's only one tangent. Right, it's backwards. But these things, these demonstrations have always to be made very carefully. If you try to do it the other way, it seems quite difficult to start with a tangent. You have to have a definition of a tangent. I can do it the other way. I had originally another one. You want to see a demonstration the other way? It's rather amusing, so I'll show it to you. Suppose that you say this.
Okay.
By attention,
you got the idea. This was after the lecture, and some of the students came up with some rather naive questions, stupid questions.
One of the things that I'm impressed with is that this student was asked an incredibly dumb question. I mean, I am no scientist, and I understand that it was a dumb question. Feynman did not put him down.
Feynman got the Nobel Prize in 1965, there he is, over there, and later on did other things in physics that probably would have merited another prize. After the death of Arlene, he became rather sexually promiscuous, and I don't want to do amateur psychology, you know, maybe it's that no other woman could match Arlene, or maybe he was just afraid of getting too close to someone again. I don't know. He was very open about it, and so, because of him telling stories that we know so much about his sex life, and he certainly didn't deceive women, but he probably left lots of broken hearts behind. He had a very short second marriage after he got back from Brazil, and then in 1960 he married a third time and settled down. Married Gwyneth from England, and she was a pretty sexy character herself, so there was a tumultuous courtship, you might say. Feynman died in 1988 after a long bout with cancer, but he's still very much alive. There are lots of Feynman fan clubs. Al has been on the net discovering these things.
Well, first of all, Warren, we have to check you out. The advanced nerdity test. Nerdity test. Has two different references to asking if you read Feynman stuff. I'm going to pass this around. This is a copy of some first day covers. I don't know if any of you remember the triangular stamps.
Yes.
The only time ever that the United States issued triangular stamps. But there are some stamps that have been proposed to be Feynman stamps.
And Tuva in Mongolia issues stamps. And one of the things that Feynman along the way had said was that he always wanted to visit Tuva. He loved the spelling of the capital, and I'll have to find the reference to that spelling. And any place with a spelling of that, and something like T-Z-K-Y-K or something like that. And anything with spelling of that type has to be a magical place. And so the stamp collectors sort of considered him as an honorary person. The other thing is that there's an awful lot of reference to Feynman in terms of educational theory. Because of his styles of teaching and really moving to get his students involved in curiosity, there's a lot of reference and a tie-in and use of his theories of teaching, or at least as people attribute those as theories to him, including one site that deals exclusively with how to teach using Legos for individuals.
There are lots of Feynman stories. At his memorial service, his friend and occasional collaborator, Murray Gell-Mann, said, quoting Gell-Mann, "He surrounded himself with a cloud of myth, and he spent a great deal of time and energy generating anecdotes about himself." Gell-Mann angered the Feynman family, but he was right. Some of the stories were published in two little books, sort of as told to books. "Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman," and "What Do You Care What Other People Think?" How many of you have read this? I mean, much to the, only a few of us, much to the publisher's surprise, they became sort of big hits. We have time. Well, we'll see how it goes. Let me give you one story. I'll read this, most of it. This is when he was in Rio de Janeiro. So he says he loved the samba music, and nearly went crazy for it. And then when he got down there, there was the carnival, and he was in this music. Well, wait a minute. Do I? Pardon me. Oh. There was a man at the American Embassy who knew I liked samba music. I think I told him that when I had been in Brazil the first time, I had heard a samba, how do you pronounce it, samba? Samba, thank you, a band practicing in the street, and I wanted to learn more about Brazilian music. He said a small group practiced at his apartment every week, and I could come over and listen to them. There were three or four people. One was the janitor from the apartment house, and they played rather quiet music up in his apartment. They had no other place to play. One guy had a tambourine, and another guy had a small guitar. I kept hearing the beat of a drum somewhere, but there was no drum. Finally, I figured out it was the tambourine, which the guy was playing in a complicated way, twisting his wrist and hitting the skin with his thumb. I found that interesting, and I learned how to play it. It's called a pandeiro. Then the season for carnival began to come around. That's the season when new music is performed. They don't put out new music and records all the time. They put them all out during carnival time, and it's very exciting. It turned out that the janitor was the composer for a small samba school. Not a school in the sense of education, but in the sense of fish, from Copacabana. Now this samba school was a thing where guys from the favelas, the slums in Rio, would come down and meet behind a construction lot where some apartment houses were being built and practice the new music for the carnival. I chose to play a thing called the frigidiera, a toy frying pan made of metal about 6 inches in diameter with a little metal stick to beat it with. I can't even imagine it. It's an accompanying instrument which makes the tinkly rapid noise that goes with the main samba music and rhythm and fills it out. So I tried to play this thing and everything was going all right. We were practicing, the music was rolling along, and we were going like 60, when all of a sudden the head of the bateria section, a great big black man, yelled out, "Stop! Hold it! Wait a minute!" And everybody stopped. "Something's wrong with the frigidaires," he boomed out. "Oh, Americano, outra vez," the American again. He learned Portuguese in order to get along in Brazil. So I felt uncomfortable. I practiced all the time. I'd walk along the beach holding two sticks that I'd picked up, getting the twisty motions on the of the wrists, practicing. I kept working on it, but I always felt inferior, that I was some kind of troubled and wasn't really up to it. Well, it was getting closer to carnival time, and one evening there was a conversation between the leader of the band and another guy, and then the leader started coming around, picking people out. "You," he said to a trumpeter, "you," he said to a singer, "you," and he pointed to me. I figured we were finished. He said, "Go out front," in front. We went out to the front of the construction site, five or six of us, and there was an old Cadillac convertible there. Get in, and well, anyway, they went out, and he was picked to be a part of the band in a performance for pay somewhere. The band leader pocketed the money, and Feynman didn't get paid. To practice, he would he was an American living in a hotel in Rio, and but he couldn't appear with the band for the practice. He dressed up like an American tourist, so he'd get a dirty T-shirt, and so he would look like the rest of the performers. And but then with that dirty T-shirt dressed like that, he couldn't go out through the hotel lobby, so he had to go out below and use the servants' entrance to get in and out. Anyway, they had a good performance at the carnival. Feynman was interested in rhythm. That doesn't mean he was interested in music. He had no appreciation for harmony or melody. Once at Los Alamos, he was annoyed when a colleague was playing the recorder. We should have brought one along. And he said, quote, the recorder is an infernally popular wooden tube for making noises bearing a one-to-one correspondence to black dots on a piece of paper. He wasn't all that into literature or poetry either. When he applied for graduate school at Princeton, he was way up top in mathematics and physical science, but something like the 10th percentile in literature and in the arts. You got a story?
Well, I have
a Feynman story.
I have a few things to call on. One of Feynman's most public events, other than his Nobel Prize, was testifying in relation to the space shuttle disaster. And in that, he says it appears that there are enormous differences of opinion as to the probability of failure with a loss of vehicle and of human life. The estimates range from a roughly 1 in 100 to 1 in 100,000. The higher figure, 0.01, comes from the working engineers, and the very low figures, 0.00001, from management. What are the causes and consequences of this lack of agreement? And then he goes on to say, what is the cause of management's fantastic faith in the machinery? Feynman did a lot of other research in...
Actually, could I say some more about the Challenger?
The commission hearings were televised, and the dramatic point in the commission hearings came when there was some discussion of the gasket, the O-ring, and Feynman was sitting with the commissioners, and there was some ice water for the commissioners to drink, and so he picked up the material for the O-ring gasket and put a clamp around it and put it in the ice water, and then after a couple of minutes picked it up and took the clamp off, and the ring did not, you know, the ring retained its the indentation from the clamp. It didn't go back to normal, and the inference was that when the Challenger took off on a cold morning, the gaskets weren't working properly, and hot rocket gases went through the gaskets and eventually got to the hydrogen tanks and blew the whole thing up. Anyway, it's sort of a dramatic thing. It was picked up on national TV. But his dramatization of it really, really zeroed in on, focused public attention and official attention on the problem in a way that reports by the other engineers in NASA wouldn't. So Feynman's dramatics helped point the finger on the people who were making the wrong decision. Yeah.
Maybe go a little further towards the interpretation.
Okay.
Program.
Okay.
The stories to interpretation.
Okay.
Thanks.
You had another story?
Well,
there's one story I won't in here that I won't quote him. He's again talking about himself as an amateur scientist. So he's sitting in his room as a graduate student at Princeton. Looking at ants walking along the windowsill. And so he does lots of experiments to discover how ants knew where to go, essentially experiments in finding out about insect pheromones, chemical messengers. And so he'd pick up the ants on little paper boats and transfer them around, and he'd have a sugar cube as a lure for them, and he'd have all sorts of fun. And he describes that in some detail, and I think he calls himself a kind of amateur scientist there. There are other stories. Okay, one more story before interpretations.
Right. Well, the interpretations and stories are commingled here with Feynman. We can't really separate them. Feynman went off on after he did his quantum electrodynamics research and the Nobel Prize to investigate nanotechnology, building theories that says that we can begin building extremely small devices, both physical and biological, by building them up an atom at a time. And there is a $250,000 Feynman Prize that's offered for significant advances in nanotechnology that's available. So if anyone wants to compete, Feynman says, it is our responsibility as scientists, knowing the great progress which comes from a satisfactory philosophy of ignorance, the great progress which is the fruit of freedom of thought, to proclaim the value of this freedom, to teach how doubt is not to be feared, but welcomed and discussed, and to demand this freedom as our duty to all coming generations. And another time he said, scientific views end in awe and mystery, lost at the edge in uncertainty, but they appear to be so deep and so impressive that the theory that is all arranged as a stage for God to watch man's struggle for good and evil seems inadequate. Feynman was a furious critic of pseudoscience. He was invited to Seattle to give a series of lectures, and in those lectures he spent the first one talking about what science is as opposed to technology. The second one he spent a lot of time talking about the ethics of science and the freedom to investigate, and then went off on a tangent in talking about really the differences in cultures during the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. And his third lecture he called The Unscientific Age. He says a lot of people claim this is a scientific age, but it isn't so. And then went on to explain how we have people selling us vitamins without valid research to go behind them. How we have parapsychologists who claim that they can bend spoons. He goes on to criticize heavily psychologists in their rat experiments. And in another instance, talks at length about how a person by the name of Young did research to evaluate the variables in rat experiments. The research was trying to find out if you could always cause the rat to go to the third door. The rat, regardless of where you started, and the rat always returned to where the food was the first time. Why? A researcher worked and worked and worked with those rat experiments and finally found out that it was the sound of the floor by that door that was the cue to the rat picking that particular door. But that person's research was never quoted following up. And subsequent researchers using exactly the same apparatus did not use the methods that he had developed to eliminate that effect in the research, and he was very critical of these types of activities. And he labeled this process cargo cult science. And the cargo cult comes from this paragraph. It says, I think the educational and psychological studies I mentioned are examples of what I would like to call cargo cult science. In the South Seas, there were cargo cults of people. During the war, they saw airplanes with lots of good materials, and they wanted the same thing to happen now. So they've arranged to make things like runways, to put fires along the sides of the runways, to make a wooden hut for a man to sit in with two wooden pieces on his head for headphones and bars of bamboo sticking out like antennas. He's the controller. And they wait for airplanes to land. They're doing everything right. The form is perfect. It looks exactly the way it looked before, but it doesn't work. No airplanes land. So I call these things cargo cult science because they follow the apparent precepts and forms of scientific investigation, but they're missing something essential because the planes don't land.
Just follow up. Feynman didn't especially like philosophy, and I picked out that Albert Einstein quotation on program. It sort of fits Feynman, too. He wasn't any kind of systematic philosopher. And he was profoundly atheistic. And I think, you know, the idea of being curious, open to new experiences, goes along with this kind of atheism. Let me quote from the lecture that Al was quoting from. It's necessary and true that of all the things we say in science, all of the conclusions are uncertain. They're only guesses. What we call scientific knowledge today is a body of statements of varying degrees of uncertainty. Scientists are used to this. We know that it's consistent to be able to live and not know. Some people say, how can you live without knowing for sure? I don't know what they mean. It's this kind of acceptance of uncertainty, sort of Feynman type of science, leads him to be very skeptical or hostile to theistic religion. At his father's memorial service, the rabbi asked him to recite a Kaddish, and he said, well, I don't know Hebrew. And then the rabbi said, well, let's do it in English. And Feynman thought that was quite hypocritical. His father was an atheist too, and he almost, well, maybe he did cause a scene at the memorial service, and his mother burst into tears. Let me go back and give you another interpretation of Feynman. If you read what historians and social scientists write about science and scientists, you get two different kinds of images. On the one hand, you get the picture of the scientific genius and the idea that progress in science has been the product of a very small number of geniuses, from, you know, Galileo and Newton down to people like Einstein. And Einstein is perhaps the 20th century's best image of the scientific genius. And so shortly after relativity theory was first published, people said, well, there are only about a dozen people in the whole world who really understand this theory. And that's the kind of image you get. And, you know, it's a flawed image. I think high school students, good high school students, can graph relativity theory, and it's not especially difficult. On the other hand, there's this kind of democratic image of science. Science is a method, and just any reasonably intelligent person can use the method to make discoveries. And so what we call scientific knowledge is the product of lots of people, ordinary people, using the method over a long period of time. As you might expect, there are good reasons for supporting both the elitist and the democratic points of view. Sociologists of science demonstrate great inequality in scientific productivity, especially if you look at who gets cited in later papers. About 2% of scientists are responsible for over half of the citations in the scientific literature. Feynman knew this. In my interview, he told me that, you know, physics, more than most other scientific disciplines, physicists focus on a limited range of problems. Feynman said there are only a few leaders in really fundamental theoretical physics. A recent biography of Feynman is by James Gleick, is titled Genius. And I think myself that's a misleading title, because Feynman himself, I think, created an image of the scientist in the democratic mold more than in the genius mold. So it doesn't take an extraordinary genius to go around seeing if people can be somewhat like bloodhounds, or doesn't take a genius to infer that ants make trails where they leave something that other ants can somehow smell, and things like that. And so the image Feynman constructed was this kind of a democratic image. And you know, I think his little books, like Surely You're Joking, have this kind of message. You know, it's not all that difficult to be a curious character. You and I should be like Feynman, be curious about nature, and be open to new experiences, like looking at ants or smelling books. And you should be open to new ideas. And I think that it's that kind of openness that goes along with this atheism. You know, if you really, you know, religion usually is couched in terms of eternal verities or something like that. And it means closing things off. Actually, let me just say one more thing about the atheism. Feynman's views about religion are obviously not the last word on the topic. So here's this guy who's really not interested in music or literature and things like that. Actually, in my interview with him, at one point he sort of expressed a little irritation, saying, "You really should contradict me, argue with me. You know, that when I talk to physicists, that's what happens. People don't passively listen." Anyway, I do agree with Feynman that you're not going to learn much about the meaning of life, or meaning of human existence, from the physical sciences, and physical science cosmology, I don't think it's all that relevant to religion. But that clearly doesn't exhaust religion. And you might say that religion really is about, you know, based somehow on human relationships. And Feynman wasn't all that good when it came to human relationships.
Warren, I have the one last short quotation that I want to do, but I think that what we want to switch to is whether anyone else has any thoughts about Feynman, if they've heard anything or have read anything that they'd like to comment on.
I have a question. Did they have any kids, and what did the kids go into?
He did have two children.
And his son went into philosophy.
his sister was a physicist as well.
Actually, he got flack from women, you know, this sexual promiscuity stuff. And Al said that today he'd probably get fired from the University of Wisconsin. I mean, he promiscuous. That meant undergraduates, graduate students, spouses of friends, you know.
Don,
do
you have?
I was going to say.
Oh, I didn't finish the whole. Oh, okay. Anyway, he defended himself against these militant feminists by pointing to his sister, and it was due to his encouragement that she became a physicist herself and got a PhD. And her parents, back there in the 1920s and 30s, her parents thought that science wasn't for women. She, you know, they discouraged her, but he encouraged her.
Now,
I just wanted to say I participated in the viewing and learning from the videotapes of Feynman. Mm-hmm. He presented the information on chalkboard going up and down, but he would run across the whole stage. The tapes were very well done in that they captured the feeling that Feynman wanted to present on all these different principles he was talking about. It occurred when I was at Bell Labs before AT&T dissolved. Those were the days when we had time to get into other studies.
I just wanted to ask what exactly you got the Nobel Prize for.
Developing this theory of quantum electrodynamics, quantum field theory, sort of, it really links quantum mechanics and the theories of relativity in a consistent theory that yields all sorts of really precise predictions. And it can be extended to other particles, but there were later revolutions in physics that he contributed to as well. His colleague Gell-Mann invented the quarks, but Feynman made a contribution to that as well.
Any others? Don't limit yourself to what you know or what already exists. Be an explorer, not a tourist. Look across disciplines. Dare to follow the beat of a different drum. Your inspiration may come from the dance of molecules on a wave in the sea, the complexity of a beehive or of an ant colony, the march of stars across the heavens, the nature of memory and language, the symmetry of a snowflake, and so on. There's no end to it. After all, nature's imagination is richer than ours, so why not use what we know of it to our advantage?
That's fine.
That's fine.
I just want to ask a question because of it. How does somebody who's iconoclastic and innovative like that get published?
He impressed people with his intelligence. And actually, you know, he didn't really, his list of publications isn't all that long. And what he said to me was there are little things that he discovered that he published things right away. But the really important papers he would really work on and then publish them. And There are a lot of eponyms for Feynman in the physical science, in physics. There are Feynman diagrams, Feynman laws, and so forth. And when he was a graduate student, they recognized his brilliance already. He was sort of famous.
You see, the type is large, and each item has a lot of additional information on it. It's only 4 pages of all of the materials in the Los Alamos Library having to do with by or about Feynman. Very small bibliography.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Cindy for allowing me to be here. I was supposed to be down with students today, and yesterday she told me she'd take over class, so I said, at any rate, I think the greatest thing about Feynman is that he could take extremely complex ideas and present them in ways that any one of us could understand. And this whole idea of quantum chromodynamics, or electrodynamics of Feynman, for which he won the Nobel Prize, was basically to explain how things seem to be able to create action at a distance without touching something. And in reality, what he showed is that there really is an exchange of particles, that you literally pull photons out of the vacuum. You create them momentarily every time you move an electron. And this photon then transmits the information from one place to another. So when you have a magnet and a draw a piece of iron or something like that, it's really not action at a distance, but there's actually a particle that's created out of the vacuum, out of nothing, that is exchanged between the magnet and the iron. And he largely demystified a lot of physics by just making it so visual and so really understandable. Joe Mond, by the way, got his Nobel Prize on not quantum electrodynamics, but quantum chromodynamics. He said that quarks had this property which was analogous to charge, but not the same as charge. It came in threes instead of twos, and he decided to call it colors because these things blended to produce effects that were very comparable to the way colors blended. So his work was very analogous to Feynman's, except that it dealt with the forces that hold the nucleus together instead of the forces that hold electrons to nuclei.
Thank you very much.
Those were great stories, by the way. I first heard of Feynman because my ex-husband went to Caltech and worked at Los Alamos, and that was in the mid-60s, and he has Feynman's 3 lectures, the 3 volumes. I don't know if he ever had Feynman himself as a teacher, but I heard stories about the man, and that was the most important. Okay, it's good to see Frank Iltis back here. It's been a while. We don't have any guests or visitors, I don't think. We just have a member coming back and saying hello. Today I sent around the announcement box because there are concerns about our length of services, and so I'll double check with the program committee and see how they feel about this. This is something that's been done on and off, and I'll just read through them now. Everyone, today for the pizza lunch and service auction today, our major fundraiser. Lunch is at 11:45. There is a cost for that, which you will find out. Linda has a bake sale in the front hall. Orange is our auctioneer. She's got about an hour that she's going to give to us. And there is child care available. And tally sheet. Would whoever wrote this tell me about the tally sheet?
You will get a tally sheet to keep track of lunch and all your costs. And we give those to you, and then you'll pay Judy at the very end.
Oh,
so you'll keep track of what you purchase, your lunch, and your auction items.
Okay. Nice change there for the process. Okay.
Don't add it up as you're going. We don't want you to know what you're
doing. Just get caught up in Orange the auctioneering. And, this afternoon, Carolyn Gage, a feminist playwright and actor, is giving a lecture. The topic is when sex is not a metaphor for sexual intimacy, it has to do with abusive relationships. It's free, it's at First Society this afternoon at 4, and there will be a reception after, which is being hosted by Interweave. Today is a Prairie Fire deadline. Anne, are you our guest at this point?
I don't know. What do you think, Marilyn?
Oh, I'll give it a try. Oh, great. Okay. Well, Marilyn is now plunging both feet forward into being a Prairie Fire editor, so get everything to her. And if someone gets something for Prairie Fire that is supposed to be an issue, forward it to, or otherwise get it to Marilyn.
Yeah, the green folder is that.
Okay.
If we want to use email this afternoon,
yes.
What address?
Either to me personally or to the exec PC or something.
That's right.
I'll check that.
Yeah. Okay. In this issue.
What address?
Oh, I'm prepping at hotmail.com.
Okay.
That way I'll know it's for the Prairie Fire, so it might be better to go that way.
And the Prairie Fire looks pretty. Prairie's email address, prairieu@uftcc.com. In this Prairie Fire, there will be the agenda for the spring meeting. So if anyone wants anything on the agenda, they should see me or Marilyn. Also, there will be the slate of candidates for the spring election. There will be a board meeting this Tuesday night at 7 p.m. It's an earlier time than we've had in the past. And major topics will have to do with agendas on the spring meeting. GA delegates, those of you who have concerns or wants to be one, let the board know. It will be a topic at the board meeting this Tuesday.
Where is GA?
Nashville. So some people are driving. We have room for 3 delegates this year, and we also have looked for, and we have got someone who is a youth who is planning to attend. So even if you can't go as a delegate, you might want to consider attending since it's a drive instead of a flight. This Thursday, March 23rd at 7:30 p.m., Brian Yukums, the new director of the LGBT Campus Center, will have a hour-long roundtable discussion. I will post this so you can get the other information, contact information from this. Fran Zell has published a book and lyrics to a new musical called Lavender Rose, in which Alex and Emily come out and fall in love, but not necessarily in that order. Auditions are being held Sunday, March 26th at 5 p.m. and Monday, March 27th at 7 p.m. at Neighborhood House in South Mills. Please come prepared to sing a song of your choice. Performances in July. Contact Fran Bell or Nancy Phillips and we'll have a poster on the board. Men's Homeless Shelter at Grace Episcopal Church, looking for 2 breakfast staffers from 5 to 8 a.m. this Tuesday, March 28th. Let Paula know if you're interested. Okay, now important spring business-related stuff. The Committee on Committees. Need for a social action chair. Information from KK. Usually they meet at Prairie the first Tuesday of each month. Volunteers needed for Prairie Programming Grounds. Sign up now. That might be on our sign-up board, or it might be the committee. Who wrote this? Who can tell me? Volunteers needed for programs and grounds. Okay, I assume I got it right then. The Central Midwest District Conference, April 28th through 30th, Music Our Unifying Spirit in Appleton, Wisconsin. Karen Gross's extra brochures. Registration deadline is March 31st. Those with children in RE have received an OWL, Our Whole Lives survey. They're due back the end of March. Box on the back table at Prairie, and that's from Rachel Long. Ceremony committee needs suggestions as to the best places near Prairie to house out-of-town guests. See Dolita. the big ride for the American Lung Association that Phoenix is planning to ride on coast to coast on June 14th. Looking for more donation information was in the previous prairie flyer, and there's also information in the meeting room where you can talk to Phoenix or Metchie. And the U.S. Census forms you've all received in the mail. This year there's a change. It's called the unmarried partner. If you're in a live-in relationship, be sure to mark the category unmarried partners. This is mostly coming from the gay and lesbian community, but there's other situations where this might apply also. So do fill out your census and send it in. Anything I may have missed? Betty.
Preliminary annual dinner is next Saturday night. And the notice is on the board here.
Okay. Yes?
Jose,
yes.
You might want to comment on the material in the corner over here.
Oh, these cases?
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, I couldn't get it going in time for this morning's program, but...
It's part of the donation that Kay and I were making to where we decided to get a couple items that were back stained glass and a couple things. And one of the things that we did get was a PA system with a remote mic.
Thank you very much to both San Jose.
It was tested out and it works. You were here
Thursday. Oh, great. Now you just have to show the people how it works and need to know. Rachel.
I want to make this very brief. We have new folders for the talent sliders, and there's two important changes. If you want to join, that you can fill out the slip that's on the back of the brochure and mail it in directly to Central Midwest District rather than having to meet go through it. And I'll tell you, we have 22 people signed up. We did have 25, three have dropped out of the program, but I haven't been able to recruit anybody. So here, The object of Chalice Lighters is to help the district churches with their problems. And the one thing that was dropped from there was trying to get ministry for a group. So that's too big an order, I guess, but there are other things that are needed. So if you want more details, talk to me.
Okay, thank you. Any other announcements, Perry? Okay, our last hymn is For the Beauty of the Earth, number 3 in the Prairie Songbook.
It was sort of hard to pick out hymns for this program because Feynman didn't like music and he didn't like religion, so...
Thank you.
fun and the food and us all.
Thank you, Warren. I never heard the name until I read it in our bulletin.